You are listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 4th of October 2022 on Monocle 24.
Ukrainian troops retake more territory in regions illegally annexed by Russia, with advances towards the city of Kherson. Meanwhile, over the actual border, are Russians finally starting to learn what's actually going on with Putin's so-called special military operation? And how is Western unity holding up as economies falter and governments decide what to do with Russian men fleeing conscription? I'm Vincent McAvinney. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to The Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Vincent McAvinney. On the 222nd day of the war, we're checking in on the situation in Ukraine, Russia and both sides' allies. My guests Stephen Diel and Sasha Dovshik will discuss the day's biggest stories, and we'll cross over to Pennsylvania, where Monocle's Chris Cermak has been spending time on the campaign trail. Stay tuned, all that and more to come right here on The Monocle Daily. Well, this is The Monocle Daily. I'm Vincent McAvinney, and today I'm pleased to say I'm joined by two panellists. Sasha Dovshik is a special project curator at the Ukrainian Institute in London and lecturer at the School of Slavic and East European Studies at UCL. And Stephen Diel is a writer, broadcaster and Russia analyst. Welcome to you both. Stephen, you've been enjoying a British staycation, is that right?
I have indeed. I've sat in this chair for this programme on a number of occasions with hearing tales of travels around the world to very exciting places. I think there's some pretty exciting places actually in this small island of ours. And yes, I was in Cornwall last week, which is a very particular area for those who don't know it. It has its own language, mm-hmm. Which is very difficult.
Its own separatist movement as well.
And there is own little separatist movement, yes, its own flag. But it's got some beautiful countryside, and of course it's by the seaside as well, although it was a little too chilly to go on the beach.
Yeah, winter is coming. And Sasha, you've very recently returned from Ukraine, is that right?
That's right. I was there from the very beginning of the full-scale invasion, and I think Ukraine was probably the most exciting place in the world to be during those past 7 months. So I had a chance to witness the resistance, the volunteers' movement, the way Kyiv stood through the full-scale invasion, and Lviv supported the people who were fleeing from the southeast and north of the country.
Well, a great panel today to discuss our focus on the war in Ukraine. And the latest update from the Eastern Front is that troops have retaken more territory in regions Putin was proudly claiming to have annexed just 4 days ago after his sham referendums. Kyiv's forces are advancing near the southern city of Kherson and towards eastern Luhansk. Russian installed officials in Kherson have confirmed the advance, but claimed Moscow's forces are digging in. Sasha, if I can come to you first, how significant is this progress, and what would recapturing Kherson involve?
The progress is indeed significant, and I think in great extent it is significant because it is unexpected. Again, Ukrainians managed to do the thing that nobody believed they could do, to recapture their territories that were believed to be Russian for good. And I think that the success of Ukrainians on the battlefield puts a question for us. What can we do to support the movement of Ukraine forward? What kind of weapons are we ready to provide for them, because they have proven that they can take back their territories if they are given the means to do that.
And Stephen, Putin, of course, claims the civilians in these areas voted overwhelmingly to join Russia. Do you think we'll see them taking up arms to repel their actual countrymen?
I think it's highly unlikely. I mean, I just find the theatre of the absurd really has taken off now with Russia. I mean, the whole war has been terrible anyway, but the more that Putin gets pushed into a corner, this mobilization, which I know for a long time he did resist and was pushed into it by hardliners simply because they were the ones who were saying, come on, you know, we're not looking too good, we've got to get people. Calling the mobilization in his own country is one thing, and we've seen a lot of people leave, as we'll talk about in a minute, I believe. But how he can expect people in these regions, which they say, or they now belong to Russia, when they people who live there don't feel they belong to Russia, I can see soldiers, if they're conscripted there, actually simply walking forward with their hands up and surrendering and or fleeing to the Ukrainian side. They're Ukrainians. I mean, you know, there is no military sense to this. You don't take over a part of a country and then say, right, we want you to fight against your own countrymen. It's just not going to happen. And it's just another desperate move by Russia to try and cover up the huge numbers of mistakes they've made.
Mm-hmm. And hard to cover this up when they made such a song and dance literally on Friday in Red Square with that huge, you know, concert where they'd apparently, you know, had to bus people in. But if this then topples, it'll be pretty hard to cover that up. I mean, Sasha, if Ukrainian forces do recapture Kherson, what should be done with some of these planted officials that Putin put in place?
Well, according to the laws of war, they should be punished because this is a collaboration and this is a crime and it should be persecuted according to the Ukrainian law. It's not people who were just silently sitting through the invasion at their homes. It's people who volunteered and stepped forward and said we would probably support the invading army. So I guess the right way to deal with them is to punish them according to the Ukrainian law.
Mm. And if Ukraine does manage to recapture the city, you know, within several days of potentially Vladimir Putin having claimed that it's a Russian city, how much of a boost will that be for the Ukrainians?
Currently, we are in the phase when every day is a boost for us. Putin declared some of Ukrainian territories Russian, and the next day the town of Lyman, which is a very important logistical hub in the east of the country, was retaken. And obviously for all Ukrainians who are watching this and who are supporting their army, it's a huge boost to their morale. And we are grateful to the armed forces for keeping us safe and for taking back Ukrainian territories and liberating those people who were waiting for Ukrainian forces to return. Mm.
I think Sasha's just used a key word, and that is morale on both sides. You know, this is what we're seeing. The more gains for Ukraine, the greater the Ukrainian morale. And at the same time, the more Russian morale is going down, down, down. I believe one of the British papers yesterday, I think it was, had a summary of some of the mobile phone messages that have been sent back from Russians. And if earlier in the year I saw some horrible messages about torture, which is just ghastly, it's probably the worst thing about this has been the brutality of the Russians. Now the Russian soldiers are saying, what the hell are we doing here? I want to go home. Mm. They're firing at us. My mate's just been killed. It's that morale is clearly crumbling and on the front lines.
And this is the issue. I mean, especially with these, you know, conscripted men now, they've got their parents, their grandparents sitting at home watching the Russian propaganda saying, oh, they've all voted, they want to be Russian, and their sons are going to be texting them and saying they're taking up arms against us.
And that's a really interesting point, because in the early days of the war, we heard many tales of Ukrainians who have Russian relatives or friends in places like Kharkiv, saying, you know, why is your army bombarding us? And you know, they're under the bombardment. And Russians back in, say, Moscow saying, no, you've got this wrong. You're imagining it, or else it's the Ukrainian army. So that has completely turned around now.
Mm. And I just want to move to another issue, but it's one that really is starting to build up in chatter. Russia potentially going nuclear. And this has particularly now been given weight after reports that NATO has warned members about a nuclear train being sent towards Ukraine, possibly for a test on the border. Stephen, I can come to you first. Putin, do you think he could go for this option?
I wouldn't put it past him. I would hope that those around him, his very small circle of close advisors, would actually advise him against it, because use of a nuclear weapon anywhere simply could lead to the destruction of Russia. I mean, it really is as blunt as that. One thing I've heard, and again, it's an unconfirmed report about this nuclear train, is that apparently the vehicle which would carry the warhead was not part of it. They would not, even the Russians, would not transport a missile with the nuclear warhead attached. And this, I think, is something, when I haven't seen much talk about this, but it is a fact that when we talk about use of a nuclear weapon, it's not as simple as Putin saying, right, I'm going to nuke them and pressing a button.
There are multiple people involved.
There are multiple people, and you know, it's very complicated. And as I say, the warhead would have to be attached to a missile, be it tactical or strategic. I'm not wishing to downplay it. I mean, it is, you know, it's been talked about a lot, and Putin.
But they will, of course, know that satellites will be tracking rail lines, that they will have spotted this. So, you know, it's not being done in secret. It's not a stealth jet. It's not a submarine. This is something very obvious, isn't it?
It is. But as I say, if that report that the warhead's not there, then maybe, you know, that shows it is something of a bluff. It cannot, of course, be ruled out. This is the very frightening thing. It can't be ruled out. But I think even a tactical nuclear missile used, certainly if it's on Ukrainian territory, will mean that NATO will say, we can't allow this. There will be some serious reaction to that.
And Sasha, you know, on the Ukrainian side, the idea of this train coming towards your nation, given the history of nuclear accidents as well in Ukraine under the Soviet Union, how are people feeling about this?
I think it's important to understand that there are two components to this Russian nuclear blackmail. First is what we've discussed, the threat to use nuclear weapons against Ukrainians. And the second is the fact that Russia is, of course, the first power in the world to bring war to a site of civilian nuclear infrastructure. I happen to come from Zaporizhia, and as you may know, Zaporizhia is the region which hosts the largest nuclear plant in Europe, which Russians have occupied and have been shelling mercilessly since the beginning of this full-scale invasion. Apart from that, they are also using violence against staff who are ensuring the safe running of the plant. So I think that we should not underestimate the danger of this behavior, and we should keep our eye on that side as well. And just to speak about Russians at the nuclear power station, the fact that they might not want to blow it up does not mean that they will not blow it up because of their negligence and ignorance. Mm. There is a history of them coming into the Chernobyl exclusion zone in February and March and digging trenches in the Red Forest, which is, of course, one of the most contaminated nuclear sites in the world. That did not stop them, and I believe that hundreds of Russian soldiers got nuclear radiation poisoning as a result of those actions. It's impossible to imagine Ukrainian armies doing something like that because we know our history, we know about the Chernobyl accident, we know what radiation hazards are, and we know how to deal with the sites of civilian nuclear infrastructure, unlike those people who have invaded and occupied them. So it is our task today to ensure that Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant is returned and to Ukraine, and it is demilitarized as soon as possible.
And vital, given its size and scale, for all of Europe, really, and much of Russia, because of, you know, just how badly it could go accidentally, as you say, even, you know, not deliberately. Well, we're going to cross over the actual border now to Russia. And Putin's grip on the media since February has seemed total, with independent outlets either being shut down or forced to operate abroad via VPN. Now, the nightly nodding heads in large command bunker like TV studios have sold the Kremlin's lines with very little dissent. But is that starting to crack? The withdrawal of Russian troops from the strategically important town of Lyman in eastern Ukraine has prompted rare public criticism of the military's top brass, not from opposition or anti-war voices, but from prominent Putin-supporting Russian figures and influential social media accounts. Stephen, if I can just ask you first, why do you think this retreat in particular seems to have sparked some criticism of the top brass?
The criticism actually started before that, when Ukraine made those significant gains back in September. That was the first time I saw on clips of Russian TV. I have to say it's very difficult to watch Russian TV for any normal person, simply because it's just... the bile is often too much to take. So I tend to watch smaller clips. It's very interesting. That was the first time you saw the cracks appearing. And now even the obnoxious Vladimir Solovyov, who is probably Putin's number one propagandist, is almost going apoplectic on some of his... He has a regular program, sort of supposedly sort of chat show, but it's a bile show. And his bile has been all about anti-West and anti-Ukraine. And it's been, you know, what the hell's going on? You know, this isn't what we're supposed to see. And some of his guests in particular have gone further than he is comfortable with in their criticism. So I think any Russian who is watching who is at all savvy, and that's not meant as an insult, but some Russians are so brainwashed, and if particularly if they don't have a VPN, so they don't really have access to the internet these days, there are still those who are in blinkers. But anyone who's got a bit about them and has followed the news a bit wider will definitely be thinking, yeah, this is serious. This is going seriously wrong.
And can you just explain, because it's, you know, everyone sitting maybe listening to this, you've probably got access to things like Netflix, to, you know, Amazon Prime, whatever. There are other options. But Russia is very much a terrestrial media environment where there is just the state broadcasting. I mean, how popular are these shows? Do people actually tune in? And is this critique just really unusual? Could there be repercussions for the people saying this?
There could be. There were earlier when we're very early on, I suppose, after about 3 months of the war. I remember there was a retired general, Ivashov, who came out and was quite critical of it. And he came in for criticism as a result, although he wasn't actually arrested. But there is always that danger. One of the most significant things recently has been a very famous singer called Alla Pugachova, who has been the star of Russian shows and singing and so on for certainly 40 years. I remember when I was a student in the Soviet Union, going back 40 years, and everyone knew Pugachova and loved Pugachova, and she has recently come out and has criticized the war, and her husband Maxim Galkin was labeled a foreign agent, and she said, "Well, label me a foreign agent then as well." And that she got some criticism, but she's still free and able to speak out. Definitely the cracks are appearing, and it's a very different sort of Russian media now than it was 3 or 4 months ago.
And Sasha, also, of course, in this war, social media playing a big part in it. We've seen the way that Ukraine has managed to build support around the world, you know, very savvily using short clips and that kind of thing. Do you think that, you know, even the social media with the front lines and what's been happening, the success of Ukrainian troops, do you think that that is getting back and sort of bursting the bubble a bit in Russia?
One thing that I surely know is that Ukrainians are deeply unimpressed with whatever developments of so-called public opinion are happening in Russia, and they are not following the space as closely as they probably used to a decade or two ago. Mm-hmm. There is no belief in Russian civil society or in any kind of mythical Russian uprising anymore in Ukraine. So what Ukrainians are doing on social media is mostly directed at Ukrainians and at our allies in the West and around the world, not at Russians, mm-hmm. because there is no hope there.
One of my favorite, can I just say very quickly, one of my favorite things I saw on social media was from the Ukrainian Defense Forces saying, now, come on, West, you know, it's about time you gave us more weaponry, because at the moment, our main supplier of weaponry is Russia.
Oh, and of course, there was this absolutely beautiful appeal of President Zelensky to the indigenous people of Russia and also of ethnically non-Russian people who are inside the Russian Federation. And he was underscoring the fact that they are represented more than ethnical Russians in the army that has been thrown at Ukrainians as cannon fodder. And he was advising them to give up weapons and choose Ukrainian captivity over certain death at the hands of the Ukrainian army. I think that was a very effective appeal.
Mm. And Stephen, just one final point on this. I mean, you can't, you know, listen to a broadcast in Europe or America or pick up a paper without hearing about the cost of living crisis. We've had umpteen sanctions put on Russia now. How is there any reporting in Russian media of the kind of day-to-day lives of Russians, how they've changed? Is it hard? It must be hard for them to not notice now that when they go to a shop, the same things aren't there, that things are more expensive.
But that has been had a lid put on it. Russians, they know themselves, but the reality of life. I mean, very early on, a tongue-in-cheek joke that I heard from a Russian was, well, you know, we're with all the Western companies pulling out, they said, you know, we're used to having the latest technology for the latest iPhone. Well, we've now got the last one. So there's been a certain wry humour there. But Russian media, I haven't seen reports of them saying, you know, oh, you know, cost of living crisis. That's one thing they're still trying to play up, that yeah, these Western sanctions, they're not really affecting us. Well, guess what? They are. Mm-hmm. In two principal ways. One, the consumer way, which will worry Putin less, although that's, he makes him a bit nervous because he doesn't want his people to be so unhappy that they might start a revolt. But the other way, of course, the really serious way, is when it comes to industry, and including military industry, they are not able now to produce the sort of weaponry, the sort of vehicles that they need, because they're missing vital Western components.
Mm. And we're going to turn now and move to Russia's borders. The past few weeks since the mobilization have seen flights sell out and queues forming at checkpoints in Georgia and Finland. The latter has now closed, effectively shutting off the EU from Russians. But for those who managed to make it out, there is a question now of how host nations treat them. Sasha, from a Ukrainian perspective, what do you think? Is there anything that can usefully be done with these people to help support your country in the places that they've escape to?
Mm-hmm. First of all, I think it's, again, important for us to understand that people who are fleeing the draft dodgers, they're fleeing not because they disagree with the Kremlin's policy and Kremlin's invasion of Ukraine. They are in full support of Russian genocidal war in Ukraine. They just want other people to kill Ukrainians instead of them. And obviously, they do not want to die in Ukraine on the battlefield. So I would not just trump their fleeing the Russian Federation at the moment as some kind of heroism. Mm-hmm. It's also important to focus our attention on those refugees who are fleeing the actions of the Russian army, on Ukrainian refugees, on those who are suffering from the actions of those soldiers who are being thrown at Ukraine currently, and think that those people, mostly women and children, would now be sharing our, like, attention space with these Russian men, and also the actual physical space outside of their country with these women and children. Is this the right way to treat Ukrainian refugees? I think we should just go back to focusing on those who are suffering from this invasion and not on those who are fleeing from certain death.
And Stephen, this creates a headache for, you know, European governments in multiple ways, because it's, you know, as you say, as Sasha said, you know, how do you treat these people that have come over, prioritised, and Ukrainians that have fled, but also for intelligence services as well. There might be some, as Sasha's mentioned, who, you know, are still completely on board with the war, and they might actually act to try and help Russia from outside of the country, even though they don't want to go fight themselves.
It's not an easy question to answer at all. I saw a report from a human rights lawyer saying that, oh, you know, these are refugees, therefore they should be treated as refugees, they should be given refuge. But the point that Sasha's made is perfectly valid, that, you know, well, they didn't complain about the war. They're only complaining about they might get called into it. You know, there's a certain part of me which says, well, as you've made your bed, so shall you lie on it. And I can imagine, I see perfectly why Finland has closed its border now. There were so many fleeing. Those who go to Georgia will find, those Russians who go to Georgia will find that they're not now being welcomed. There are so many of them there. There already were from the start. There was initially something of an IT influx, so IT people who had left early on in the days of the war. But even then, Georgia, after a few weeks, was getting rather fed up with the numbers of those. Georgia will not be happy to have all these Russians on their territory. And one of the reasons is the exact one that you say, that how many of them are sleeping agents who are being sent there rather than just fleeing a potential call-up? Because, again, it's that age group. It's the sort of 20s and 30s, men in their 20s and 30s, some of whom no doubt are actually agents for the FSB, the GRU, military intelligence. So it's not a simple question. I don't have a simple answer to it either.
Mm. And it's so difficult because for European governments, they're in danger of annoying their own voters by supporting or seeming to help these people when they are going to be facing this cost of living crisis. Well, that is an issue that governments are going to be debating in Warsaw. Top politicians and defence industry representatives are gathering in Poland for the Warsaw Security Forum that started today. Monocle's Andrew Muller is also in the city, and he joined me a few moments ago to tell us about the discussions on the first day of the event.
So far, as you can imagine, it is pretty much all Ukraine. This does seem to be a conference where the motif is principally trying to figure out what we have learned from nearly 8 months of this conflict, both diplomatically and militarily, and how the military lessons affect the diplomatic and vice versa. But that's pretty much it. It's Ukraine with an interesting side order of climate change, actually, and how that is likely to impact on thinking about defense and military stuff in future.
And who all has been talking there?
Lots and lots of people. There's been a lot of presidents and prime ministers, mostly from the Central and Eastern European region. The Polish prime minister spoke earlier today at one of the bigger panels. But it's akin to GlobeSec, another forum we visited a few months ago, in which you do get quite an interesting mix of current and former office holders. And as you can imagine, the former office holders are usually more fun to talk to because they'll tell you what they actually think.
And just looking at the discussions that have been going on, what have been the most interesting lines from you?
The most interesting lines that we've heard have not been so much from the panel discussions, but from the interviews we've done. And more of those will be broadcast on our shows and on this weekend's edition of the Foreign Desk. But in particular, though, it's Luxembourg is not an especially enormous diplomatic heavy hitter, as you can imagine. But we spoke to François Balch, who is Luxembourg's defense minister, and he made the very interesting point that the diplomatic and the military are very much intertwined where Ukraine is concerned, because a big part of the challenge facing European governments will be continuing to try and sell this war to their publics over what might be a long, expensive and difficult winter. And he was stressing that recent Ukrainian progress on the battlefield is very important in enabling that, because you are able to tell your people who may be cold and maybe, losing money at home, that there is a reason for this. This is meaning something. You are not making these sacrifices in a losing cause.
And you mentioned climate change a few moments ago. That ties in with this, doesn't it? Because if there was ever a moment to really sell the public in many countries on the fact of moving to renewables, it's the fact that we need to break the grip of being beholden to sort of states controlled by the likes of Putin that produce oil and gas.
Oh, absolutely. People are being very careful not to do the every cloud silver lining bit, because that would obviously be a fairly callous way to discuss what is happening in Ukraine. But yeah, that's absolutely a thing. People realizing, or at least embracing, the idea that this calamity in Ukraine has made this a practical rather than a theoretical imperative. It means it's something we have to do now, not that we hope to get around to later. Earlier today, we spoke to Christoph Heuschen, who is now the chair of the Munich Security Conference, but he was previously Germany's ambassador to the UN. And more interestingly, to our purposes before that, he was the primary foreign policy advisor to Chancellor Angela Merkel. And asking him about, obviously, the decisions that were made about trying to entwine Russia in Europe's energy and economic architecture, he said, in retrospect, it didn't work out brilliantly. He was willing to acknowledge that mistakes were made, possibly with the best will in the world. You can only operate with the facts you believe you have in front of you. But he did also make the point that he thinks, and clearly not for the better, that Vladimir Putin's thinking and his view of the world has evolved since 2012 as well.
Well, yeah, the current state of Nord Stream 1 and 2 would show that it definitely has done, if the allegations are to be believed. And just a final question for you. Now, there's been a lot of talk about nuclear, and obviously there was some sort of hyperbole perhaps in it, but there are now reports coming out that NATO is warning specifically about a train, a nuclear train that is being spotted on satellite images heading towards Ukraine, potentially for some kind of test on the border, or perhaps even for nuclear tactical weapons to be used on the battlefield. Has there been much discussion there of that issue?
There's been a lot of discussion of it, and we are hopefully speaking to one or two guests tomorrow who might be able to shed some particular light on that. But the discussion is mostly fairly theoretical, because obviously nobody really knows what Russia would, you know, in extremis actually do. But I think people have understood that over the last 8 months that assuming that Russia is bluffing, or assuming especially that Vladimir Putin is bluffing, is probably not a good idea. And again, this, you know, pertains to the conversation we had earlier with Christoph Heustjen, that the trouble is that it's very hard to communicate threats in stark red line variety language about what we would do if Russia did that, because then you trap everybody in a kind of escalatory ladder, which possibly nobody really wanted to put a foot on in the first place. So there's a lot of concern about it, but not really any hard and fast answers, unfortunately.
Monocle's Andrew Muller there, speaking to me from the Warsaw Security Forum a little earlier on. And bringing back our panel now, there's been a lot of criticism of some nations, and particularly today there's a lot of talk about France for not doing enough to support Ukraine. A recent analysis on the ground showed that only 2% of arms deliveries were coming from the country, compared to 49% from the US, 22% from Poland, and 9% from Germany, which has sort of ramped this up after criticism. What does this show about Macron's response, and also just where the international community is at on this, Sasha?
Yeah, I think it's very important that our allies understand that Ukrainians are fighting not only for the Ukraine, for Ukraine alone, but for the entirety of the European continent. And if our allies are not willing to put boots on the ground, so to speak, supplying us with weapons is paramount, because it's clear that Russians are warfaring not only against Ukraine, but also against us here in the West. It's clear from the energy blackmail, from the from playing with prices on that market, from stopping Ukrainian grain exports and just sponsoring instability, funding the far-right parties. So if we don't want to see a rise of neo-fascism here in the West, in France including, we should do everything we can to stop Russia, first by supplying weapons, but also by dispelling Russian propaganda and Russian disinformation campaigns. I think it's very important.
That's a particular risk given a winter perhaps of economic hardship adrift. We've already seen Italy go to the far right, and for France particularly, you know, the main now military force in Europe, it is a slightly difficult day. Absolutely. With those stats coming out. And Stephen, if I can just turn to you one last thought, Putin's allies, there aren't many of them, but how are relations with the likes of Belarus, China and others?
Belarus is, you would think it would be the most obvious one, but even there, Lukashenko is done a bit of sitting on the fence. I wouldn't say that he is entirely behind Putin. He can't afford to upset Putin too much, but he hasn't really thrown his military weight behind Russia, so that's interesting. China and India, both very interesting. I would take people back a couple of weeks to the Shanghai Cooperation Summit, where even Putin admitted that Xi had raised some questions. And certainly the Chinese haven't given Russia or sold Russia any military equipment at all, which is very interesting.
Despite that big agreement, that we're BFFs agreement at the beginning of the year, and the show at the Sochi, at the Games in China.
Absolutely. And, yeah. But China is looking after its own interests, and China's interests are far more with economic ties with the rest of the world. Russia doesn't matter that much to them. And the fact that Modi came out and actually, from India criticising the war and saying, you know, you should be seeking peace. I think that if I were Putin, I would feel that I don't really have a great deal of allies anywhere apart from perhaps Belarus, but even that's a bit wobbly.
And dangerous being backed into a corner if you feel alone given that train.
It could be,
yes. Well, Sasha Dovshik and Stephen DL, thank you so much for joining us on the Monocle Daily today. And we're going to end the show with a report from the United States. With just 1 month to go until November's congressional midterm elections, Monocle's new Washington correspondent Chris Samak has been spending time on the campaign trail in the more rural parts of the blue-collar swing state of Pennsylvania.
John Fetterman is more than 2 meters tall. He's tattooed, wearing a black hoodie and basketball shorts as he walks up to the stage in Bethlehem to AC/DC's Back in Black. Fetterman spends a few moments taking it all in, as if taken aback as the crowd of around 1,000 supporters chant his name. It's been a challenging few weeks for Fetterman, the Democrats' candidate for Senate here in Pennsylvania. Having suffered a stroke in May, he's limited these kinds of rallies. He's also had to answer repeated questions about his health and fitness for office from his Republican opponent, the TV celebrity Dr. Mehmet Oz. Here in Bethlehem, he tries to turn it to his advantage, asking the audience if they've ever suffered a debilitating health condition themselves.
And I also pray that you never had your doctor in your life making fun of it, making jokes about it, telling you that you're not fit to serve or able to do this.
Although Fetterman has a degree in public policy from Harvard, his speech in Bethlehem is light on the issues, heavy on humor. He's getting a lot of mileage over this viral video clip of Dr. Oz complaining about the rising price of crudité, a French raw vegetable dish.
I thought I'd do some grocery shopping. I'm at Wegner's, and my wife wants some vegetables for crudité, right? So here's a broccoli. That's $2. Not a ton of broccoli there. Guys, that's $20 for crudité, and this doesn't include the tequila. I mean, that's outrageous. And we got Joe Biden to thank for this.
Casting your opponent as out of touch is a time-honored tradition in American politics. Just ask Barack Obama whether he regrets talking about arugula. So Oz's crudité gaffe has been a godsend for Fetterman.
In PA, we call this a veggie tray. And if this looks anything other than a veggie tray to you, then I am not your candidate.
In John Fetterman, Democrats believe that they've found their own version of an anti-establishment populist to challenge Trumpism. And the stakes here could not be much higher. Pennsylvania is one of a handful of states that could decide which party controls Congress after November 8th's midterm elections.
So I'm here not just for this, but just because this part of the state, race for governor, a couple of congressional races here that will help decide which party controls the House. Obviously, the Senate race could decide which controls. So Pennsylvania's a big deal.
This is John King, the CNN news anchor and chief national correspondent. The key, John King says, is turnout.
In midterm elections, turnout usually drops down. We saw in 2018 it went up. Was that just Trump? We had a 2016 presidential election and the 2020 presidential election, turnout went up. 2018 midterm turnout went up. So was the 2018 an aberration just because of Trump, or are we in an age of higher participation?
For Democrats, the Supreme Court's ruling striking down a federal right to abortion in June is expected to be the key driver of that higher turnout, along with fears that America's democracy is under threat from an increasingly extreme set of Republican candidates.
I live in a town. I live in a battleground town, in a battleground county, in a battleground state. We are pretty much 50-50. I have neighbors all around me that are Trump supporters. I have neighbors around me that are Shapiro and Biden supporters. My Republican neighbors are very vicious, they're very hateful, and we need to get that attitude out of this country.
And do you ever try to convince them or even have conversations at this point?
Good question. I used to, I gave up. I cannot possibly have an intelligent conversation with a Trump supporter. I lost a lot of good friends that I've known since second and third grade who are diehard Trump supporters. We have no contact anymore.
But step outside the Democratic rally bubble into rural America and, well, it's a different world. A Republican rally on the steps of the state capitol in Harrisburg for Doug Mastriano, a far-right former military officer running for governor, draws only about 50 hardcore Republicans. It begins with a not-so-typical opening prayer.
Gather on in. Men, women, we're living in a time where we're being marginalized, we're being kicked to the curb, and Jesus said something about this. He said, if the...
Listen to the cast of speakers, and it's clear that passions run high among Republican voters, too, just for wildly different reasons. Here's Tabitha Velo, who runs an organization called Free PA.
In politics, but in 2020, when they infringed on our constitutional rights, that was a wake-up moment for me. That was, we are an uneducated generation on what our constitutional rights are. They had no right to shut our churches down. They had no right to shut our businesses down. They had no right to slap a muzzle on our children's face. It was time for me to take action.
There are also more conspiratorial warnings, like this one from Republican State Representative David Zimmerman, one of several Pennsylvania legislators who received subpoenas for their potential role in the January 6th riots on Capitol Hill.
Now they even use the FBI to scare us. And guys, I'm one of those. FBI looked for me all day long, but what I do that they didn't know is I turn my tracker off. But guys, if they can come after me, they can come after all of you guys as well. Just know that.
Now, with inflation rising and the economy nearing recession, this should be a year for Republicans to win states like Pennsylvania once again. And Dr. Oz in particular has been seeing his poll numbers rising against John Fetterman in the last couple of weeks. But what's also clear is that many of the more extreme Republicans endorsed by Trump in this election cycle are struggling to generate enthusiasm and hurting the party's chances of retaking Congress. But whether Democrats like Fetterman can really capitalize in November and find their own message to reach blue-collar middle America, the jury's still out on that one. For Monocle in Pennsylvania, I'm Chris Chermak.
Well, that was Monocle's Washington correspondent Chris Chermak. Do be sure to tune in throughout this month for special reports from him on the issues driving November's congressional midterm elections. Well, that's all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to our panellists today, Sasha Dovshik and Stephen Diel. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie and researched by Emily Sands. Our sound engineer was Callum McLean. I'm Vincent McAvinney here in London. The Monocle Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye and thank you for listening.